Kishore Mahbubani, former Singaporean ambassador to the UN and currently dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, one of Asia's most influential policy institutions, confirmed the need for institutional reinvention. "There has to be a big reshuffling of the deck in terms of global governance," he told me. "I mean, you cannot have a UN Security Council that represents the victors of the 1945 war. As a result, one thing I would say, by 2045 they will no longer be there in those roles, because between now and 2045 the world is going to change profoundly. It has already changed profoundly. And it is simple. If the changes are not going to happen, they will lose their legitimacy. The core question is, who are they speaking on behalf of? By the year 2050, three of the four largest economies in the world will be Asian. 1. China. 2. United States. 3. India. 4. Japan. How can you exclude them from appropriate ownership or leadership of the IMF or World Bank? How can you exclude some of the biggest countries in the world from meaningful roles in the UN Security Council or coordinating mechanisms like the G7? The former UN Deputy Secretary General Mark Mallock Brown also believes the system needs an overhaul, arguing, however, that we should not be too quick to forget what does work. You have to be really very hard-headed about what comparative advantages the UN system brings to the table in any given issue, he told me. But we shouldn't overlook that these organizations have the ability to bring clean water to a couple of billion people, or to close the investment gap in a country, or to persuade the North Koreans to stop launching these missiles into the air. It just needs to be put into perspective. We are government organizations, but that is no longer enough. We are stuck between being where we started as a kind of intergovernmental civil service in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, and some new role as a global advocate and entrepreneur. An informal affair, the sovereignty versus democracy trade-off. Implicit in this analysis is the fact that these institutions can't do it alone. They must work with the private sector and form new kinds of partnerships. From the perspective of the superclass, this means a number of things. First, the formal intergovernmental institutions are in trouble, and thus the influence of their leadership as members of the superclass is waning. Second, the international issues that they should be dealing with are meanwhile growing in importance and are being dealt with increasingly through informal mechanisms. These mechanisms are created to fill a void and often funding gaps, but they shift power in ways that make even the ungainly and inequitable governance structures of existing international institutions seem more egalitarian, or at least more directly oriented toward the interests of people at large rather than businesses or the rich. Instead of institutions dominated by the victors of World War II and the leaders of the industrial West, you have individual governments, or clusters of them, or weak multilaterals collaborating with private sector leaders, or all of these collaborating with a few richly endowed NGOs, solving problems, allocating resources, setting rules. Governments may stretch limited dollars, but they give up autonomy. Further, they may fill small slices of the global governance gap, but without a clear mandate from those they are impacting, or with a big imbalance that gives special leverage to the private sector or subsets of countries that offsets that of the multilateralists. And at the core of the groups filling that gap are members of the superclass, the elites who run the big financial institutions, the big investors, key corporate leaders, billionaires, philanthropists, and even a handful of superstar artists who can drive or shape NGO activities. All that said, many of these activities provide important value, and their existence is far better than the void they fill. A considerable number are found in the medical field. The global public-private partnerships that form the core of more than half the activities of the World Health Organization, for example. Or the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, GAVI, Gavi, which is 75% financed by the Gates Foundation, or the TB Alliance, which also has both public and private finance. Another example is a recent initiative of the Aspen Institute, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, OPIC, a U.S. government agency, and the Palestine Investment Fund to create a Middle East Investment Initiative, an international collaboration of leaders from the Palestinian, American, and European private and public sectors to help fund the creation of jobs for Palestinians. The program is an outgrowth of discussions from Aspen's Middle East Strategy Group, co-chaired by Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright. Yet another illustration is a recent effort by the EU to develop greener aircraft, a 1.6 billion euro project called Clean Sky that is half funded by governments. All of these particular programs certainly offer admirable goals, but with much of the funding coming from private rather than public sources, clearly the underwriters have influence, whether it is the Gates Foundation's seat on the Gavi board or the aviation industry's 800 million euro stake in Clean Sky, thus shaping just how green the project may be, how fast it may develop, and where it will focus. Joseph Stiglitz, who was chief economist of the World Bank, observed to me that we have this sovereignty problem. Some governments don't like participating in international institutions because they can't control them. But in a democracy, no one can control everything. The only person who can ever be assured of getting his own way in a government setting is a dictator. As hard as it may be to swallow giving up sovereignty in order to empower these institutions properly, it is important to see that our conduct of international economic policy is often, in some ways, undemocratic. For example, we delegate the writing of intellectual property rules to a small group of trade ministers, who often know little about matters of either intellectual property or science. The ministers often do this in collaboration with the special interest groups they work with most closely. Now, are these the right people to be setting these rules? Or consider another case. Letting the IMF be in charge of sovereign debt restructuring is akin to letting private creditors run our bankruptcy system. In America, would we ever even contemplate such an institutional arrangement? He pauses for a second and then adds, too many people, other than those linked with special interest groups, have simply been disconnected from these issues of international economic policy. So the reality is that whether it is because institutions are too weak and insufficiently democratic, or because people aren't engaged enough in the process, we are leaving key decisions to the special interest groups and those that lead them. In the case of banks running debt restructurings, the financial institutions have an obligation to their shareholders to maximize repayment in a way that may run directly contrary to the interests of the citizens of the borrower country, who may prefer the country invest its limited capital in social or job creation programs, for example. It may also be in the interest of developed nations to see such programs supported because they might promote stability, whereas the bank's focus on meeting obligations to them might actually produce stresses that promote unrest. This kind of tension is precisely what caused Argentina in 2001 to stop working with banks and the IMF to restructure their debt and essentially go it alone, without the blessing of the leaders of the international financial system. The country had a terribly rough time as a consequence, but eventually it bottomed out and has begun to recover on its own terms, and the decision by then-President Nestor Kirchner to fly in the face of the public-private alliance at the heart of the financial community has, in retrospect, become comparatively popular among his people. Elites in the financial community have resisted suggestions that they be regulated by some new supranational entity or entities analogous to those found in domestic markets. They have pleaded for self-regulation and liberalized markets from the national leaders whose campaigns they financed and who depend on their collective judgment in the daily market referendum to which I referred earlier. and thus far, more or less, they have gotten precisely what they sought. The centrality of such approaches can be heard in the earlier comments of Robert Rubin and in conversations with people like Timothy Geithner, a former Rubin protege who is today president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Inside the Fed's looming office building, just 3 blocks away from the New York Stock Exchange, Geithner seems out of place. The offices are imposing, and the building itself is designed in the monolithic style of a financial temple from an earlier era. But Geithner is very youthful-looking, friendly, and slight. He is indeed comparatively young, only 42 when appointed to the post in 2003. He served in the Clinton Treasury Department, where he played a key role in managing the international economic crises of the late 1990s, and proved himself calm and effective even under difficult circumstances. Because of the New York Fed's role in managing relations with other central banks and the financial community, it has become a crucial cog in the global financial system. Geithner acknowledged that a significant portion of the work done today to manage markets, from currencies to derivatives, must be done in conjunction with the leaders of the world financial community. "We have a convening power here," he told me, "that is separate from the formal authority of our institution and which can be a very powerful tool. There is a debate among economists about how powerful it is relative to traditional tools of, say, monetary policy. But I think history has lots of examples of the use of convening power in ways that were effective. The work with financial institutions during the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s, the work on managing the potential fallout from the collapse of the LTCM, long-term credit management, the work following the Asian crisis that I was involved in at Treasury." He emphasized that the role of central banks remains important and spoke admiringly of the work that the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, has done to ensure that the world's top central bankers convene every 2 months to share perspectives and ideas. He observed that the principal tables there now have 26 countries around them. China is always there. While he cited this as an example of strong collaboration among governments, it is also worth noting that only a fraction of the world's countries are involved, and that the BIS is not an organization selected for this role by the voters in any country. Rather, these meetings are themselves part of the world's semi-formal structure, which is evolving out of an agreement among the most powerful countries on how they would like to see the management of the planet's financial affairs handled. In the same vein, Geithner observed that this community of actors has become very interconnected, and that he, in fact, probably speaks more often to them than to all but one or two key players in the U.S. Fed system. "I spend a lot of time with these central bankers, and they have world-class educations and experience. They share similar training and perspectives. We speak a similar language." Geithner suggested that within this community, collaboration with big corporate players is key. Recalling a situation in which he had to manage a crisis in the derivatives market, he said, "What we did is, we got the 14 major firms in a room down the hall here with their primary supervisors, a group of the largest global institutions and their supervisors from 5 countries. And we said to them, 'You guys have got to fix this problem. Tell us how you are going to fix it, and we will work out some basic regime to make sure there are no free riders to give you comfort, so you know that if you move individually, everybody else will move with you. And there is nothing written, no guidance, no regulation, no formal process. We did it without a formal request to us. We told everybody we were going to do it, but we were not asked to do it. These 14 firms,' he continued, 'accounted for something like 95% of all the activity in this market. The Fed, the SEC, the FSA, the Swiss, and the Germans were there. And those were the principals, and each firm brought 3 people. They had an executive committee of 4 firms that ran, almost weekly at the beginning, a conference call among the other firms. And the best thing about the process was that it was efficient. There was nothing written except letters from the firms laying out their commitments. There's no formal mechanism we could have used to force this on anybody, so we had to invent it. I think the premise going forward is that you have to have a borderless, collaborative process. It does not mean it has to be universal, every jurisdiction or every institution. It just needs a critical mass of the right players. It is a much more concentrated world. If you focus on the limited number of the 10 to 20 large institutions that have some global reach, then you can do a lot. It's interesting, actually, of the 14 big firms, Chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs Lloyd Blankfein jokingly called them the 14 families, like in The Godfather. The Japanese were not in it, which was interesting. It is really the Swiss, Germans, U.S., U.K., really mostly the U.S. and Europe. No Asian firms. Geithner's predecessor, Bill McDonough, now vice chairman at Merrill Lynch, echoed his perspective. Central bankers work together well because they spend a lot of time together, he told me, such as at the frequent meetings of the major central bankers at the Bank for International Settlements and at the annual meetings of the IMF and World Bank. They learn why other central bankers are following particular policies. They become personal friends. That is especially helpful in crisis management, of which I had quite a lot when I was president of the New York Fed. For example, I spent a good portion of the night before the meeting with the private sector of long-term capital management informing the central bankers of Europe what was happening and why. Being able to call them by their first names as friends made those conversations much easier. Richard Darman, senior advisor at the Carlyle Group and chairman of AES Power, has observed from high atop the system the changes that have taken place, first in the public sector during the Reagan administration. Coming out of the 1970s and perhaps through the early 80s, two members of the G5 Club of Central Bankers, the U.S. and the German, were especially powerful. They were sometimes called the G2. Together, they could exert extremely important influence upon currency relationships and global financial markets. By the time I became Deputy Secretary of the Treasury in early 1985, however, he continued, the increase of private capital flows had already been sufficient to make clear that the role of the G2 in particular, and central bankers in general, was going to decline in relative importance. The powerful Fed chairman Paul Volcker came to realize, somewhat reluctantly, that his world was changing. Because even a widening club of central bankers could no longer control currency relationships, the central bankers needed to involve the treasuries and finance ministries from their respective countries in order to influence the full range of public policies that, in turn, influenced private flows and markets. At the time, I was part of the team that negotiated two of the key financial agreements of that era, the Plaza Agreement and the Louvre Accord. They represent significant deviations from the world of the old central bank club, not only because they were the product of a group that included finance ministries, but also because they addressed a whole lot of policy variables that were far beyond the traditional scope of central bankers. They reflect the fact that the club was expanding bureaucratically, geographically, and substantively in order to do the same old job in a bigger, more complicated world. By the 1990s, private capital flows had come to dominate so much that central bankers were borderline irrelevancies in terms of what they could do through intervention. Their regulatory powers gave them some control, but there were ways to get around much of their reach. So the club expanded further to include a bunch of the financial players you have talked about. And those financial players themselves were increasingly globalized to adapt to the increasing scope and complexity of the real economic world. So what does it really mean now to be a member of such an expanded club? Darman felt that the group itself had become somewhat broader than it was, and less bound by traditional class distinctions like inherited position, but he acknowledged that it is still a small, small group with very significant impact worldwide. The financial superclass is not, however, the only group filling the void created by the weakness of global institutions. As Thomas Friedman pointed out to me, we now have a whole set of issues that have arisen as globalization has intensified that require global governance, but there is no global government. So that creates a fundamental core problem. Not only is there no global government for all these issues which require global governance, there is not going to be global government. Sovereignty is always going to trump that. So the question is, then, what fills that gap? Well, what fills that gap is, to some degree, NGOs operating transnationally on discrete issues. What fills it is sometimes global coalitions. Maybe it will be the Fair Labor Association working to get governments to convene textile companies with NGOs to set a global standard for these companies about sweatshops. A new thing that is emerging to fill it in is supply chains, the whole relationship between Walmart now, Nike, McDonald's, and the NGO community. For example, Conservation International worked with McDonald's for several years on a set of standards for their supply. Who buys more beef, bread, pickles, and tomatoes than McDonald's? So how its suppliers farm their land, whether they do it in an environmentally sustainable way, is a huge issue. I mean, that is global governance the way it is done in the world today. Today, estimates suggest that NGOs worldwide have total turnover in excess of $1 trillion a year, making them a force to be reckoned with. John Elkington, co-author of a study on NGOs published by Sustainability, says that amount is augmented by levels of public trust surpassing that of governments and business, and that as a consequence, NGOs might evolve into among the most influential institutions of the 21st century. The relevance of this group as part of a continuum of policymakers and influencers is highlighted in the environmental arena in Daniel Esty and Andrew Winston's Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage, in which they write, "Today, the governmental role is changing as rulemakers and watchdogs expand both vertically and horizontally. By vertical, we mean the different levels of government. Down the vertical scale, we find state and local officials who have been more aggressive enforcers of environmental laws than the federal government. At a higher level, we see global agreements like the Kyoto Protocol. The horizontal dimension refers to the emergence of new actors tracking environmental performance, such as NGOs and bloggers with websites read by millions." One of the largest and most influential members of this horizontal governance matrix is the Worldwide Fund for Nature, a Swiss-based NGO with an annual budget of over $120 million and operations in 90 countries. On the one hand, the WWF leadership, including its president Chief Emeka Anyaoku of Nigeria and its international director General James Leap of the United States, is seen as enormously influential. They represent more than 5 million members around the world and an organization with more than 4 decades of history seeking to promote biodiversity and preserve the environment. WWF has invested over $1 billion in more than 12,000 projects worldwide, has played a central role in helping to preserve species from the tiger to the leechwe antelope, and has lobbied for everything from the preservation of fresh water to sustainable development policies. But with a mandate to work closely with governments and corporations, the WWF has also run afoul of critics with other environmental organizations who cite the close ties between the organization's leaders and big business. There was a chorus of protest in 2003, for example, when a top WWF U.S. official, Catherine Fuller, who also served on the board of U.S. aluminum giant Alcoa, refused to join other WWF International members in voting to oppose a major Alcoa hydroelectric dam project in Iceland. Critics also noted that Alcoa contributed $1 million to WWF, which was seen as a further compromise to its objectivity. Similar attacks have focused on relations between the organization and other corporate supporters, including France's Lafarge, a mining and quarry company, and HSBC, the international bank, which gave the WWF over £35 million in what was at the time a record-breaking donation, but that was seen by critics as an effort to buy cover for its investments in environmentally unfriendly forest operations and dams, such as China's notorious Three Gorges. Defenders of the WWF correctly note that few organizations have done more to raise awareness of biodiversity and environmental issues, and that part of the reason for their success is their ability to work closely with governments and businesses. Yet critics suggest that this closeness is a compromise, and in this disparity of views lies one of the problems associated with the rise of NGOs as proxies for governments. Their accountability is limited, and they are inevitably driven by checkbooks, thus opening the way for further influence for the resource-rich members of the superclass. This kind of public-private collaboration has become central to global governance in everything from managing the trade of counterfeit goods to managing energy market supply disruptions. From getting medicine to victims of epidemics like AIDS, to restricting travel in the event of pandemics. From interdicting terrorists' financial flows, to containing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, the number of such instances is growing as more and more activities become cross-border, and thus, by definition, move beyond the jurisdiction of individual nation-states. So on the one hand, you have weak international institutions, and on the other, you have growing global governance needs. Informal institutions evolve. Some are public-private, like those described by Geithner and Friedman. But others are public-public, such as networks of government representatives who collaborate to coordinate policies on everything from trade to security-related issues. For example, senior officials from different nations find themselves linked together in clusters based on alliances formed by virtue of history or circumstance or complementary missions and resources. They develop personal connections both while in office and out, consistent with the perception and definition of our concept of superclass. Former EU Trade Minister Lord Brittain and former United States Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky both spoke to me about the close ties they formed with their counterparts in the trade community and the fact that many maintain ongoing relationships today. As we will see in the next chapter, senior military officials speak in the same way about relationships developed within NATO or in joint military-to-military initiatives. Former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger told a similar story. The National Security Advisors had a kind of club. I don't mean a club in a formal way, but in an informal way. I had a drop line in my desk to the National Security Advisors of France and England and Russia. We did a lot of business that way. That cuts across the bureaucracy. It cuts through the bureaucracy of foreign ministries. During Kosovo, there were a lot of decisions that got made by my dealing directly with my counterparts in Chirac's office and Blair's office. These political clusters, or clubs as many seem to identify them, form around specific tasks, although central alliances and historical relationships play a key role in defining them. In much the same way that the G5 aircraft links together leaders in the corporate world, and some in the public sector, the G groupings of nations create informal mechanisms that play a significant role in defining global policy outcomes and common agendas among participants. We have heard already how the G2 was important among central bankers before it was overtaken by the G5, the G7, and the G10. Among trade ministers, the United States and the EU were also the G2. The big dogs who, when working together, drove the rest of the world on many critical issues. On other trade issues, the Quad, the G2 plus Canada and Japan, was key. The institutionalization of concentrated power is periodically challenged. For example, trade ministers met in Cancun, Mexico in 2003 to try to advance the Doha round of world trade talks. Drawing on approaches used in the past, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick and EU Trade Commissioner Pascal Lamy tried to guide the meeting, seeking a compromise on agricultural subsidy reform that they had envisioned. But a group called the G20 Plus, led by countries like Brazil, India, China, and Indonesia, resisted their pressure, instead re-emphasizing calls for the United States, and particularly the EU, to eliminate distortionary trade subsidies for their farmers. Such subsidies are important revenue streams for European and U.S. farmers, who also fear being pushed out of the market by cheaper imports from overseas. For the developing world, however, they amount to an impenetrable barrier, allowing local farmers to sell their products at below-market prices that make it impossible for foreigners to compete with them. One of the G20 Plus leaders, Brazilian Foreign Minister Celso Amorim, came out of the meetings sensing a watershed, saying, "We emerge from this process stronger than we came into it." The most famous of the G groupings is the G7, which was established in 1976 and includes the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Britain, and Japan. The G7 finance ministers meet 4 times a year, with the central bank governors attending 3 of those meetings. In 1997, Russia was invited to join the G7, creating the G8. Although it does not participate in economic and financial meetings because of its comparatively small GDP. It does, however, participate in regular G8 ministerial meetings on energy, education, environment, development, labor, and health policy. Within the G7 and G8, there are also regular meetings of heads of state. In fact, from a global policy perspective, this group has become one of the most influential mechanisms of informal coordination on the planet. For example, while the majority of world leaders who get FaceTime with the American president see him infrequently, and only a few may do so as often as once a year, leaders of other G8 countries have much more regular contact. In 2006, President Bush met privately with each G8 leader an average of 3 times in addition to the discussions that took place at that year's leadership summit in St. Petersburg, Russia. These bilateral meetings are not all business all the time. A state visit by Japan's Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi in June 2006 was one of the more memorable of the Bush administration, culminating with a tour of the home of Koizumi's musical hero, Elvis Presley. After 2 days of discussions, military displays, and a state dinner in Washington, the pair took off on a field trip to Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. On the way, "Don't Be Cruel" played over the Air Force One PA system, and Elvis DVDs aired on monitors while flight attendants served the classic Elvis snack: fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches. At the estate, Presley's daughter Lisa Marie and ex-wife Priscilla arrived to lead a guided tour for the special guests, though they let the heads of state share some private time together in the meditation garden where Elvis and his parents are buried. Later on, standing in front of the famed Jungle Room, Koizumi was moved to put on a pair of Elvis-style sunglasses, swivel his hips, and belt out several bars of "Love Me Tender" for the press corps. Bush laughed but did not join in, and then sent the PM home with a jukebox loaded with Elvis hits. Beyond the G7-8, there are other G groupings, each creating similar clusters for the leaders and top representatives of its member nations. Among these are the Group of 20, established in 1999 to fill in some of the gaps created by the still more powerful G7-8. This group, which meets just once a year, actually represents 90% of global GDP, 80% of global trade, and 60% of the world's population. The G24, which was established in 1971, meets twice a year to discuss development issues and includes a broad cross-section of developing countries. The G77, founded in 1964, confusingly has 130 members and serves a similar purpose. There is also the G22, the Willard Group, which was superseded by the G33, which in turn was superseded by the G20. There is even a non-G6, also known as the Oslo Group, which includes Canada, Chile, Indonesia, Kenya, New Zealand, and Norway. Other alliances, from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, to Mercosur, to the Organization of African States, to the Non-Aligned Movement, also fill in a void, providing caucuses that guide nations as they work within international institutions or independently. These meetings, like Davos or business meetings, provide the social glue for the members of the political superclass and help bridge differences in mission or relative levels of power. Such glue is vitally important. As the former Singaporean ambassador to the UN, Kishore Mahbubani, observed to me, the ASEAN countries are meeting within themselves regularly. The golf games that they have create the same kind of role that you have mentioned. Oh yes, in fact, I say the reason why the countries of Southeast Asia have not gone to war is because of a four-letter Scottish word, golf. Such collections of powerful states and powerful leaders, both informal and institutional, lead many to believe that globalization is driven by only a few nations, often in collaboration with financial and business leaders from the private sector. Indeed, based on what we have seen, it is easy to see how that impression is created. This suspicion has had a corrosive effect, creating a fault line between those who believe globalization is in their interests and those who do not. The Global Network of Anti-Globalists. Bill McDonough sat thoughtfully in his office at Merrill Lynch, a modern suite in a building that towers above the wound in Lower Manhattan where the World Trade Center used to be. "There is a growing view," he remarked to me, "that the modern economy is benefiting the more successful at the expense of the less fortunate. In the United States, the lower half of income distribution has not been keeping up. I believe that in all societies, clearly in democracies where the electorate can change the government at the next election, more attention has to be paid to making it clear to all the people that they too can benefit, or at least that the educational system gives their children that opportunity. That is the American dream. But even in less democratic societies, governments govern over the longer term with the consent of the governed. If not, revolutions take place. In guiding globalization, government leaders, central bankers, and leaders of the business community simply have to do a better job of taking those actions needed to have all the people believe that the system benefits all." Former U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Richard Holbrooke, one of the most distinguished and respected of the foreign policy leaders within the Democratic Party, observed that the consequences of the actions of the global elite have produced what might be characterized as an anti-globalist elite. These anti-globalists are not only far removed from the worlds of London, Wall Street, and all the makeshift international networks that fill the global governance void on behalf of the most empowered countries and economic entities, they actively oppose them. "They have nothing to do with that world of what you call the superclass," Holbrooke told me. One of the points Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made in New York, according to people who saw him, was his attack on the UN as being the Western creation. And when somebody at the Council on Foreign Relations meeting at which he spoke said to him, "You know, all these countries in the UN oppose you," he said, "Wait a second. I just came from Havana, the latest meeting of the newly revitalized Non-Aligned Movement. I was with 125 nation leaders who all denounce you guys. So I mention that because there are different elites." This other group is the anti-Davos crowd. They're the anti-globalization people. So, yes, I agree with you that there are these elites and there are these networks, but they have also triggered the creation of these anti-networks. At the core of the anti-network is a small group of leaders linked by many shared characteristics and attitudes, though they come from widely different regions of the world. They might be characterized as nationalists or opponents of the United States or critics of Western-led globalization. They include Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Hugo Chavez, and Vladimir Putin. Each has fought or been trained to fight for his country. Ahmadinejad was a soldier in Iran's war against Iraq. Chavez is a military man by training. Putin was a career KGB operative. In their view, globalization is old Western imperialism dressed up in new clothes, and they are reacting to it much as they were trained to react to such incursions. Given the flow of Western products and ideas into their regions as a result of globalization and the growing international influence it gives multinational corporations, often closely associated with Western governments, it is easy to see why. Though we can also see the irony in the fact that Western governments are concerned about those multinationals disconnecting from their historic roots. Consistent with these views, that are fairly traditional in the context of their national heritages of skepticism toward Western influences, each took what might be considered a conservative path to an established elite in his country. Each is capable of great charm before his supporters and the media, and each is capable of equally great ruthlessness and cunning. Perhaps most important, each of these anti-elites comes from a country that has a national idea of itself as a great state, a regional or an international leader. Iran is the seat of the Persian civilization, once an empire that carried the peacock throne into the heartland of India. In many respects, it is the greatest modern civilization the Middle East has produced, and still today, one of the world's leading oil producers. Venezuela also draws upon great aspirations and traditions. Home to the liberator, Simón Bolívar, the man who more than any other forced the end of colonialism in Latin America, Venezuela has also enjoyed special position and influence due to its own immense oil reserves. Russia, of course, is the superpower that collapsed onto itself, one of the great defining forces of the 20th century, and a country in which virtually every adult citizen was, in the early 1990s, forced to rethink much of what he or she had been taught about himself or herself and the world. Today, it too has renewed power because of its great petroleum, natural gas, mineral, timber, and other resources. Although each of these countries has benefited from global markets, each also contains many who see the evolution of the global system as not giving them a place commensurate with their view of themselves. This in turn has been seized upon by their opportunistic leaders and their supporters, who have harnessed the reactionary forces the global era has produced among their countrymen. It is interesting to note that with just a few adjustments, a couple of twists the other way, these countries could be among the great cheerleaders of the new era. No country in the Middle East other than Israel is quite as cosmopolitan as Iran. For years, experts were suggesting that its fledgling form of democracy would make it the likely cradle of political reform in the region. It has had a vibrant artistic tradition, an acceptance of academic dissent, and has allowed women more active roles than elsewhere in the Middle East. Russia produced the burgeoning of cowboy capitalism that created the oligarchs, but that also showed exceptional vitality and flair for business among its elites. It has always been torn between its European and its Asian identities, but in the global era that could have put it in a remarkable position, a bridge 11 time zones long that could connect the dynamism of its Chinese neighbor with that of a united Europe to its west. Venezuela's oil was tapped by the Standard Oil companies. Venezuela's elites studied in the United States, and for periods in the middle and latter parts of the 20th century, there was no country in the region closer to the United States. The phenomenon can be seen as comparable to the rich who have come to despise the excesses of the super-rich in the United States. The backlash against U.S.-led globalization comes from a number of countries close to the phenomenon that are tapping into it, countries that have or had legitimate reasons to think they could be at the forefront of it all had things gone slightly differently. Their failure to achieve what others have stems from a range of missteps, including over-reliance on natural resources, lack of emphasis on education, endemic corruption, and preservation of the prerogatives of local elites. And, sensing that they have been left behind, they are increasingly lashing out. Today, Putin, Chavez, and Ahmadinejad do not have congruent agendas, but each seeks to consolidate power and to elevate his country's importance in the world. Despite their differences and the distance between them, they have found it suits their needs to work together. Increasingly central to their approach has been the politically popular choice of confronting the United States and blaming it for the ills of a world system that has left many citizens discontented. Almost one-third of Russians live below the World Bank poverty line, and almost two-thirds describe themselves as unhappy. The great inequalities between the oligarchs and the masses feed their discontent. For Putin, the choice is to accept responsibility or to identify scapegoats beyond Russia's borders, most often Chechen rebels or the United States. His anti-U.S. rhetoric has reached unsettling Cold War levels of late, to the point of comparing the United States to the Third Reich. Within 2 weeks of that controversial statement, he test-fired new missiles specifically designed to penetrate European and U.S. anti-missile defenses. Ahmadinejad has goaded the United States and Israel by convening groups of Holocaust deniers and calling for Israel to be wiped off the map. He has confronted the international system by asserting Iran's right to develop its own nuclear program and has regularly assailed the United States. The country's leadership has specifically formulated its foreign policy as a response to global arrogance, code language for U.S. foreign policy. Iran has not just offered angry threats, nor has it only played the role of David against Goliath. It has recognized that in standing up to the United States, no matter how outrageous its approach, it speaks for many other countries that see the international system as not working for them. For example, its efforts to develop its nuclear program unimpeded resonates with dozens of other countries that feel they have been made second-class citizens by exclusion from the nuclear club, a particularly potent subset of the power elite. Chavez and Ahmadinejad have exchanged visits to each other's countries. Iranian brand cars are now manufactured in the Venezuelan city of Maracay. Chavez has played up his solidarity with his Iranian brother by also allying himself with Hamas, the Syrians, and other anti-Israeli forces. Pro-Palestinian flyers have appeared thousands of miles from the Middle East on lampposts in Caracas. As one expert, Alberto Garrido, was quoted as saying, "The Venezuelan left has for decades considered alliance with Muslim countries as one of the ways to create a new civilization through the toppling of American values." Of course, Chavez has gone further with regular attacks on George Bush, calling him Mr. Danger and a donkey. He has referred to the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, whom he views as a U.S. ally, as an asshole from A to E. Chavez has built an alliance among leaders whose countries have struggled in the past several years, and many of which are just now embracing indigenous peoples into their political systems, including Argentina's former president Néstor Kirchner, Bolivia's Evo Morales, Ecuador's Rafael Correa, Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega, and, of course, his grand patron and role model, Fidel Castro. He has recreated a kind of Cold War spy versus spy mentality in the region by funding anti-U.S. candidates and revived the old Cold War development aid competition by pledging billions in aid to left-leaning nations throughout Latin America. He has helped Argentina pay off its debt to the IMF, helped Bolivia pay legal bills, pledged $1 billion in credit assistance to Ecuador, and with Ahmadinejad announced a $2 billion investment fund for the region. The aid he has actually spent is several times the $1.7 billion provided by the United States in the same period, most of which went to the war on drugs. And working with Putin, he has aped another Cold War convention, tit-for-tat arms deals. In the wake of a $3.8 billion deal to send U.S. F-16s to Poland in mid-2006, Putin and Chavez arranged to send over $1 billion worth of Russian arms to Venezuela just a month later. As long as the price of oil is strong, these countries have considerable independent resources to underwrite their international initiatives, even if those resources could be better utilized to address desperate needs at home. Pursuing their agendas to contest what they see as an unfair system, this core group has mimicked a pattern of the G8, of which Russia is, of course, a member. The leaders from within this alienated axis meet with increasing frequency. Indeed, in one of the transcendent ironies of the current era, one might say that the path of those most opposed to globalization in its current or apparent form is to create a global alliance of anti-globalists. In 2006 alone, key leaders within the Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, Iran, Russian, Syria bloc convened something in excess of 20 times, not counting meetings like the UN General Assembly or the gathering of all non-aligned nations that took place in September. Chavez alone visited China, Russia, Belarus, Iran, Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Portugal, Qatar, Syria, Mali, Benin, Angola, Argentina, Brazil, and Jamaica, and has not only forged strong ties with political elites, but developed considerable popularity as well. Speak to these leaders, however, and they might say that their alliance is not anti-globalist, but a coalition against U.S.-dominated globalization. It is hardly a mere quibble. Because of the weakness of global institutions and the fact that they have been supplanted by informal structures that are typically dominated by Western governments or private sector institutions, they are responding to a genuine deficit of global governance and a genuine reality in terms of the shape of global elites. Many of these leaders are easy to condemn as thugs and racists and crooks. But to dismiss them without assessing why they enjoy popularity at home and abroad, without understanding the traction they have gained, without understanding the needs they speak to, is a mistake. It is a mistake being made every day by many among the world's political superclass. You can hear it in unilateral and unconstructive declarations that members of the group are part of an axis of evil, or in the rolling out of tired Cold War formulas in response to 21st century problems. The divide caused by this system has begun to define political debate within and among nations in powerful ways. Whether you characterize it as nationalist versus internationalist, populist versus globalist, or anti-neo-imperialist versus pro-American globalization, these issues are shaping debates on trade, use of force, global regulation, and immigration worldwide. Global political elites face other challenges, those associated with having to respond to global constituencies as well as domestic, national ones. Earlier I mentioned world leaders campaigning on Wall Street to maintain the favor of markets on which they depend, markets that hold daily referenda on their policies and provide the investment capital they need to achieve their goals. But such challenges take many forms. Not too long ago I visited Bogota, Colombia to meet with President Alvaro Uribe about his country's struggle to win a free trade agreement with the United States. At the time, Colombia had been targeted by labor unions and human rights groups because of the high number of labor union leaders who had died in that country's civil conflict and the low number of prosecutions the government had thus far been able to pursue of the killers. Unions in the United States, with leaders like John Sweeney among the most nationalist members of the global political superclass, generally oppose free trade because of the threat they see it posing to domestic workers. In Colombia's case, they had found an issue that had traction with members of Washington's new Democratic majority and were so far succeeding in their efforts to stall the deal. We met in the presidential palace in Bogota, a beautiful city tucked into a valley in the Andes. The palace was surrounded by spit-and-polished troops, some wearing spiked helmets evocative of the World War I soldiers of Kaiser Wilhelm. Inside, we were warmly greeted by the president and his team. Uribe, who studied at Harvard and Oxford, and whose English is quite good, had been tough on crime and tough on drugs, and was extremely popular with both the Colombian people and with the Bush administration, which saw him as one of their few allies in the face of the drug threat and, more important, the threat posed by his neighbor to the east, Hugo Chavez. Indeed, since the initiation of Plan Colombia, a joint effort by the United States and Colombia to combat drugs and help stabilize the country, launched in 1999, Colombia had not only become America's number three recipient of foreign aid, it had forged what could only be seen as a kind of special relationship with the United States, one that Venezuela and Argentina had once had. Uribe had done as he had promised. 30,000 paramilitaries had turned in their weapons. Almost 600 had been extradited to the United States. The major drug cartels had been broken up, although many smaller ones had taken their place. Killings of union leaders had declined, and some of those killed were almost certainly active with the FARC and ELN rebel groups that had been waging war against the Colombian government for almost half a century. There were rumblings of progress in the dialogue with the unions. All this explained Uribe's high approval rating at home. What he couldn't understand was why he was having such problems sealing a trade deal with the United States. Uribe is a tightly wound guy, and halfway through the meeting, having listened to a stark assessment of why the Democratic Party, the party of his friend Clinton, after all, was assailing him as a violator of human rights and generally making his life difficult, he leaped to his feet. He felt he was doing everything right. Indeed, he had hired a string of Washington consultants, including Mark Penn and Joe Lockhart, former press secretary for Bill Clinton. Wasn't that the way the game was played? Shouldn't things be going better? He paced the room. He was angry and frustrated. Though globally sophisticated, Uribe was still seemingly unprepared for the reality of being a political leader in the new era, in which he had constituencies in several countries, often with views and needs that were hard to reconcile. Colombians knew, for the most part, that he was fighting tough enemies in the only way possible. But Americans far away from the civil violence had a different view. They were less interested in the gains Uribe had achieved on the ground, more focused on remaining issues like violence against labor leaders that were relevant to U.S. politics. The new Democratic majority needed to give some kind of trade victory to unions that were important to their base and that had felt ignored and abused for too long. Uribe fumed. "I hope people in the United States know that they have put me in a very difficult position. Don't they understand what this might mean for the United States in the region, for all we have achieved?" The reality, as I discussed with some business colleagues as we flew back on their G5, eating, for the record, Big Macs at 41,000 feet, was that they do not understand. They don't have to, because, for the most part, politicians still derive their power from within their borders. But increasingly, at the very top, the political superclass also depends on power centers far away. They are torn as much as are their countries. They are divided much as is the world today. Chapter 6. The Age of Asymmetry. Decline of the Titans and the Rise of Shadow Warriors. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who are hungry and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. Dwight D. Eisenhower. In the early years of the Cold War, a new idea took root in the American consciousness and its government operations: permanent war. The idea was proposed by several men simultaneously, most notably a gentleman who might be considered one of the founding fathers of the modern military-industrial establishment, Charles "Engine Charlie" Wilson, who was president of General Motors when World War II broke out, guided the company's massive war effort, and helped set priorities for the U.S. economy during the conflict as director of the War Production Board. In this capacity, when an Allied victory seemed imminent in 1944, he argued that in order to avoid a post-war recession, the country would need to create a permanent war economy. Less than a decade later, as Secretary of Defense, Wilson helped to usher in the New Look reforms at the Pentagon that marked the beginning of such a transformation. Working with President Eisenhower, Wilson set out to modernize the U.S. defense establishment, rationalize spending, and make the chain of command more efficient. Wilson was the first in a line of corporate chieftains to head the Defense Department. Following him in 1957 was Neil McElroy, the former president of manufacturing giant Procter & Gamble. McElroy took office just a few days after the launch of the Russian satellite Sputnik, the dawn of a new era in the Cold War, and his term in office oversaw the continued realization of Wilson's permanent war agenda. McElroy managed a major and costly restructuring mandated by the 1958 Defense Reorganization Act. For each of the 3 years of his term, the annual Defense Department budget exceeded $40 million, which amounted to 10% of the GDP and substantially more than half the federal budget of $70 billion. Although the United States spends more than 10 times as much on defense today, the level of the official defense budget is just 4% of GDP, 1.5 percentage points below the historical average for the preceding 45 years. The close relationship between U.S. Secretaries of Defense and the business community had begun with Wilson's predecessor, Robert A. Lovett. Prior to his appointment, Lovett was an investment banker at Brown Brothers Harriman, the same firm where Prescott Bush, a senator as well as the father and grandfather of two presidents, worked. Following Wilson and McElroy, both corporate titans, came Thomas S. Gates, who worked at the banking and investment firm Drexel & Company and later became president and CEO of J.P. Morgan Bank. Succeeding Gates was another rising star of the corporate world, Robert McNamara, who was president of Ford Motor Company at the time of his nomination to be Secretary of Defense. Such ties have continued for years, as has the idea of permanent war. In fact, the revolving door between government defense leadership positions and leadership positions in the defense contracting community has become a fixture of Washington life, one no less striking or enduring than the monuments on the Mall. The threat of conflict with the Soviet Union, made manifest by the police action in Korea, and competitive parries and thrusts from Iran and other proxies, provided a rationale for permanent war footing. That, in turn, provided a rationale for the United States to embark on a half-century of record defense spending, without question the single biggest public sector investment of any society, at any time, for any purpose, in history. Once the Cold War wound down and a momentary period of New World Order semi-euphoria had passed, the rationale for permanent war came roaring back. On September 11, 2001, in a spasm of national overreaction, the United States embarked on its War on Terror, the first ever military campaign against a feeling. This new war was undertaken in an emotionally wrought post-trauma environment and without much in the way of reasoned debate. Indeed, at the time, debate itself was considered unreasonable and, to many, unpatriotic. defense expenditures skyrocketed, sending hundreds of billions of dollars directly to military suppliers and contractors. Consequently, in a new era of corporate-bred secretaries of defense, questions began to arise. The business ties of virtually every defense chief in the post-Cold War period, from former Halliburton CEO Dick Cheney to former CEO of G.D. Searle and General Instrument Corporation Donald Rumsfeld, prompted concerns about motives, relationships, the revolving door, and the connection among all these factors and America's military policies. It is clear from the blundering execution of U.S. operations in Iraq that the orchestrators of the war were hardly the super-competent cabal that some critics have alleged. Still, there can be no disputing that the swift and instinctive reaction to 9/11 produced a revitalization in U.S. defense spending and a new ascendancy of America's defense elites, a revival that seemed unlikely as recently as the 1990s, when budgets were shrinking and meaningful enemies seemed hard to find. Since they were so lousy at managing their own war, one might wonder how these leaders were so good at persuading the country to embark on the latest expensive chapter in the era of permanent war. Three possibilities exist. One is that the threat from terrorists was so great as actually to warrant such spending. Another is that the interested parties mounted an effective campaign to advance their interests in a coordinated way. The third is that without much conscious coordination, but with plenty of unconscious selection of messaging, agenda setting, and aligned self-interest, the gold-plated power tools in the toolbox of superclass members everywhere, the result came to pass much as though it were actually the reasoned will of the American people at large. The terrorist threat in perspective. With regard to the notion that the terrorist threat is on a par with those posed by past reasons for going to war, there is little in the way of validation. The facts undermine the arguments made by the Bush administration and others in the alarmist sky is falling contingent, from terrorism experts whose relevance depends on the urgency of the threat, to the wacky fringe of quasi-racist Islamophobes who dominate the right-wing media. The very rhetoric used to describe the threat has often departed the realm of the rational. As Zbigniew Brzezinski has pointed out, terror is a tactic, not an enemy. When put in perspective, the numbers suggest that the terrorist threat is indeed something less than it has been made out to be. According to the State Department, there were approximately 14,000 terrorist attacks in the world in 2006, up from 11,000 in 2005. The number of deaths associated with these attacks rose to roughly 20,000 non-combatants from 14,600 a year earlier. While these numbers are striking, they pale in comparison to a host of other issues that might, in terms of toll alone, be considered more urgent threats. About the same number of children worldwide die of preventable causes every 12 hours as people die in acts of terrorism in an entire year. According to the UN, the same number of people around the world die of HIV/AIDS every 3 days as die of terrorism annually. Even having said that, the numbers on terrorism are still smaller than they might seem to be. Of the 20,000 people the State Department says were killed by terrorism in 2006, two-thirds died in Iraq. In other words, roughly 14,000 non-combatants died in terrorist attacks as a consequence of a situation triggered by the United States in its unprovoked invasion of Iraq in 2003. Those deaths would likely not have happened if it were not for the invasion, which leaves us with a worldwide number of non-Iraq-related terrorist deaths at about 6,000. Furthermore, virtually all those killed and injured in terrorist violence were not, in fact, Americans. In 2005, there were 56 U.S. civilian deaths due to terrorism, and in 2006, that number fell by half to 28. Of those, the majority were killed in Iraq. So, the total number of Americans killed by terrorists outside Iraq in 2006 was about a dozen. While this data may confirm that terrorism is a serious problem, it hardly suggests that it is a worthy rationale for the most sweeping reconstruction of the U.S. national security system in the past 60 years. It hardly seems to justify the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent on Iraq. Nor does it seem to warrant a wartime footing in Congress, where the defense budget request for 2008 called for $481 billion, 66% higher than it was 6 years earlier, and a larger amount in constant dollars than any year since 1985, the high point of Reagan-era Cold War spending. Is this a proportional response? And if not, why not? Even in the worst year of U.S. losses to terrorists on record, 2001's horrific toll of 2,974 fatalities, almost 15 times as many Americans died in automobile accidents, more than 6 times as many died of homicide, and more still died from either fire or drowning. Yet none of these larger threats to American life produced even a fraction of the response mobilized against terrorism. Despite claims to the contrary, there is absolutely no chance that terrorists would threaten the fundamental existence of the United States, or, in all but the most unthinkable coordinated nuclear scenarios, even have a material economic impact in the context of the overall size of the U.S. economy. Even in the nightmare scenario of a nuclear weapon detonated in a major U.S. city, the nation would survive, despite what could be terrible losses. Furthermore, there is no reason to believe that, even inflamed by our interventions in the Middle East, terrorism poses as significant a threat as, for historical perspective, a life-and-death struggle with communism, Nazism, or Japanese imperial ambitions once did. So what does the threat actually look like? Al-Qaeda, the terror network responsible for the 9/11 attacks, has an indeterminate number of members with the best estimates at several thousand. Its budget is around $30 million a year, according to the 9/11 Commission report. This is approximately the cost of one Chinook military cargo helicopter. Or, alternatively, it is, at the recent Iraq spending rate, equivalent to what the United States spends in 4 hours in Iraq. That doesn't mean they can't spend the money more effectively than the United States does in Iraq. They could hardly fail to do so. But it does suggest some limits on their capabilities. In addition, while much has been made of the power of its network structure, the lack of a cohesive, full-time organization makes it hard to estimate Al-Qaeda's true strength at any given time, and it makes it very easy for those who are inclined to do so to overestimate it. Al-Qaeda depends on the amplification of its apparent threat by the media and by overreactive governments like the Bush administration to achieve its greatest results, results that are seldom, if ever, a consequence of their direct action. For example, while the 9/11 attacks produced $16 billion in property damage in Lower Manhattan, the U.S. reaction to those attacks has, by some estimates, cost in excess of $1 trillion and the lives of more than 4,000 U.S. soldiers and tens of thousands of Iraqis, not to mention the cost incurred by the erosion of domestic civil liberties and the incalculable damage to America's reputation in the international community. In short, we have made the terrorists bigger than they really are. And the question becomes, why? Could it have been a plot among conniving, cigar-smoking business, political, and military leaders in a fusty back room? The answer is clearly no. Not just because of the lack of planning masterminds among the people who made the war on terror what it is today, but because it simply wasn't necessary to convene that backroom meeting. First, given that the U.S. political system at the time of the 9/11 attacks was in the hands of a government with the ideological views the Bush administration had toward the Middle East, the history it had with key regimes in that region, and its close ties to the oil industry and key defense contractors, no one should have been too shocked by the result. All the vectors of force from the relevant power players were pointing in the direction of the kind of militarized, unilateral adventure that materialized. In part, it was the consequence of a system where the incentive structure for politicians made adopting a war footing advantageous, and where the incentive structure of the military-industrial complex made supporting such a war footing profitable. It was also the consequence of the political mood in a wounded country, which made the United States open to such an approach, disinclined to lengthy debate, and eager for the appearance of action and strength. Furthermore, as bad as the Bush team has been at managing the war in Iraq and maintaining international alliances, it has proved exceptionally adept at managing the levers of American public opinion. I want to underscore that the above analysis is in no way a dismissal of the terror threat. It is a critique of the rationale and conduct of the war on terror, and an illustration of the perilous predispositions that in part resulted from a defense economy and political community built on the idea of permanent war. All the same, the threat posed by these amorphous networks of hostiles, particularly with regards to the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the stability of a few vulnerable states, Pakistan, Lebanon, Egypt, and a number of others, is exceedingly dangerous. An appropriate multilateral approach combining military, police, intelligence, political, and economic initiatives is certainly and urgently warranted. Recognizing the relative importance of terrorist groups and non-state actors is also critical to U.S. and Western military planners. In fact, the biggest change in the structure of the global military-industrial superclass in recent decades is its shift in focus from conflicts of symmetry, the bipolar world of the Cold War, to conflicts of asymmetry, the present, in which the United States and the West are hugely, disproportionately powerful compared to the other nations and non-state actors. While this may change over a number of years, if China continues its massive military buildup, or if Russia becomes more belligerent, or if the United States manages to alienate into existence a new alliance of enemies, it has to be expected that the next few decades will see a number of the confrontations in which the United States or its allies find themselves take the shape, as it was put by Vietnam-era analyst David Galula in 1964, of the fight between the lion and the fly, conflicts in which the fly cannot deliver a knockout blow and the lion cannot fly. This has produced some substantial shifts in the structure of the global military-industrial superclass, the decline in fortunes of some traditional players, the rise of others, a re-emphasis on different skill sets, and, as in the other clusters we have seen, a growing emphasis on global collaboration. There is still a global military-industrial superclass, but it is changing rapidly, and future changes will likely raise questions about some of the doctrines and structures that today seem untouchable.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.